Can you tell me a bit about how you came to be working with the LEVC?
Yes, it was a wonderful opportunity that happened at the end of me completing a master's in linguistics. I, at the time, was a teacher. I was teaching German. I'd always been fascinated by language, really, which I think manifested itself first in a love of languages. So I did French and German A-level, did German at university, taught German here in the UK for about 15 years and taught English in Germany, and was beginning to think of possibly pursuing a career in HE teaching. So I was thinking maybe working in a German department, linguistics department. So while I was still teaching, I did a master's part-time at Reading in linguistics, and took a number of modules on dialectology, sociolinguistics, that kind of thing, both in German and in English, and started applying for a couple of posts within HE, one of which was this role at Leeds Archive Vernacular Culture, and went up for interview and was very excited about the opportunity. So it was kind of by chance, really. I'd envisaged continuing to be in a kind of teaching education role, maybe teaching in a German department or a linguistics department. But as a result of the modules, I think I kind of realised for the first time there was a career in what I considered my hobby, i.e. dialects, accents, etc., etc., and that there were people working in this area and fascinating things going on. And it just so happened to coincide with the time when the AHRC funded this LAVC. So I arrived, I think the other two people, Catherine Jenner and Robin Wiltshire, one of whom was the archivist, one the librarian on the project, they'd been in post for 3 or 4 months, I think. So mine was a one-year contract to work on the extracting data from the field workers' notebooks from the Survey of English Dialects, and it kind of fitted in the middle of the project. So there's a bit before I started and a bit after I finished. So yes, it was kind of quite by chance, but yeah, never thought I'd have the opportunity, but it was wonderful.
Can you tell me exactly what your role was?
Yes, so there are, as you will know as well as I do, 312, I think it is, notebooks compiled by the field workers. So the handwritten IPA transcribed responses to all the questionnaire prompts. They had been archived in special collections at the university, and alongside an archivist, Robin Wiltshire, and a librarian, Catherine Jenner, we were doing a number of things. So we made digital copies of the sound recordings on, we transferred them to mini disc actually. And Robin was responsible for creating a kind of catalogue of the collection. So all the manuscript documentation, so photographs and correspondence files, and also sorting the notebooks, which were very well organised, but they hadn't been properly kept in archival conditions. Likewise, the sound recordings had been in various cupboards dotted around the English department. Catherine was particularly involved with the photographs, and so my role was exclusively as the kind of the linguist on the project, looking at the data in the field workers' notebook. So effectively, I was compiling inventories of what the SED researchers call the incidental material. So obviously the responses to all the questions in the questionnaire had been published in the basic material, but the incidental material had not been made more widely available. There was always, as I understand it, an intention to publish a set of volumes of so-called incidental material, but that never happened for a variety of reasons, principally funding, I imagine. And so I created inventories of lexical items, other things. So there, in all the field workers' notebooks, there are kind of collecting points for grammatical features or pronunciation features. So I made a sort of inventory of these. They were then published on the Leeds Archive website, ultimately. And of course now, all those wonderful field workers' notebooks, every page is digitised. And so, yeah, we can all see that wonderful data.
How do you feel about that?
Oh, it's fantastic. Since leaving Leeds, I've been privileged to continue working with the SED, because, of course, now at the British Library, I've been working with the sound recordings. So at the time I came to the library, I'd heard snippets of the sound recordings, because although we were digitizing these, we were kind of digitizing them at speed rather than listening to them in real time. So I'd heard little bits and bobs, but not heard the full sound recording. So obviously having had the opportunity to do those, and my role at the when I first went to the library was to put those online, I feel, you know, I've had a wonderful opportunity to work with both the original materials, the sound recordings, but also other people now have that. So when I went to the library to put these online, the response to that those sound recordings going online was fantastic. They've been very well received by academics, by the general public. So I'm hoping likewise the availability of this data. Obviously, it's more difficult for a general audience to interpret, but nonetheless, having, you know, browse through the online catalogue as I have done, you know, the availability of the photographs, the availability of even some of the fieldworkers' notebooks, they've got drawings and that kind of thing. So it's a wonderfully rich resource that I think, hopefully, the fact that all this material will be available, and we're talking with Leeds about how our library material can link with it, it's just a fantastic resource, yeah.
Can you tell me a bit more about what it was like to work with the response books and the notebooks?
Yeah, very excited. I mean, I am now working in the sound archive. I think there's always been a bit of a sort of archivist in me. And I remember when I was at Leeds as an undergraduate, I was very excited. I did Old Icelandic as part of my German degree. And that gave us the privilege of access to a special little room in the university library where we had a key access, because that was where a lot of the old Icelandic material was kept. And I always felt that was quite a cool, privileged thing to be one of few people allowed access to this. So likewise, to be one of the few people beyond the SED team to have access to this material. And there's something incredible about a tangible object, isn't there, about actually seeing something that these field workers took to these locations, worked on with these informants. You know, the actual object itself is, you know, a wonderful thing to look at. And obviously they're very personal, because there's lots of, I mean, they're handwritten, so they reflect the handwriting of the field worker. There's also lots of details about the informant, so some of the expressions that are in the incidental material kind of capture a time and a place and a dialect and a speaker. So yeah, it was a great privilege. And it was very strange to leave teaching. I'd very much enjoyed teaching and always thought I would continue to teach. But actually, there was something quite, teaching's manic and mad and full on all day. There was something quite nice to be able to spend time working on something that interested me relax is the wrong word, but yes, in a setting when you were given time to kind of explore something for your own interest, obviously guided by what the project wanted and by Clive and others, and to work with Robin and Catherine, who, as I say, I've always been fascinated by archives, libraries, so to be in that, although it was in the English department, it was also jointly a kind of library project, so to work in special collections. So yes, it was, yeah, a great year.
Can you tell me a bit more about what your day-to-day was like?
Yes, so we were in a little basement room in the English department, which is in a sort of Victorian terrace row in Leeds. I forget the name of the road. And so there was me, Robin and Catherine, three of us in this room. So most days I would be sat going through a fieldworker's notebook and transcribing passages from that, also looking at online resources, so checking in the OED or actually at that point the English Dialect Dictionary wasn't available online, so we had I had a set of fieldworkers notebooks, a set of kind of dictionaries and glossaries on my shelf, and so was occasionally referring to them, looking for online for things if I couldn't find anything in a print publication. Catherine would have been working mainly on the photographs, creating a catalogue of those, and Robin was varying between creating the kind of the overall overarching catalogue and digitising a lot of the audio. Clive and Oliver were directing the project. So we'd have probably weekly meetings with either one or both of those. And occasionally Stanley Ellis used to pop by and regale us with tales of the field work, etc. So, yeah, I mean, it was, I suppose, like any, I was a very junior research assistant, I suppose, looking back. So like any of those posts, there was a very fixed routine every day because I was trying to get through 300 odd books in a year. So, there was a process to go through. Nonetheless, it was fascinating because each day, depending on how long it took to get through a book, you know, I'd be moving from Cornwall to Lincolnshire or wherever it might be. So it did change. And it was Catherine and Robin were very good colleagues. So, yeah.
Can you tell me about Stanley?
Well, obviously, I was in awe of Stanley. He was fascinating. He probably popped in maybe half a dozen times over the course of the year. So I can't claim to know him at all well, but he was very genuinely interested in what we were doing and delighted that the collection was going to be kind of more securely archived. I know from what little I've heard from Clive and from Stanley that at various points from the 80s onwards, it was felt that the collection was not as well loved as perhaps it should have been. So as a result of education cuts in the 80s, I believe, for instance, the Institute of Dialect and Folklife Studies closed. So there was no continuation of that work in a kind of departmental way. There were individual academics who were doing it. Obviously, Clive felt very responsible for the collection. So I think the collection had been under threat, if that's the right word. They were worried that it might not be as well used as it could be and should be. So I think he was delighted that was happening. So, but yes, he was also wherever, whatever day he came in and I was working on whatever book it would be, he would have memories, of course, of visiting that place. And clearly what I think I got from it was how close a relationship he and I sense, therefore, all the field workers developed with these informants. And from little bits I've read, obviously, it was a very different world. These were informants who in most cases were staggered that academics might possibly be interested in their variety of English, but therefore developed a very warm relationship with people. You know, there was mutual respect on both sides because they, you know, Stanley often used to say they were the experts sort of thing. So, yeah, no, it was fascinating to meet him.
You're not old enough to have ever met Autumn.
No, not. Clive obviously met Autumn and worked under Autumn and spoke very highly of Autumn. I've seen photographs of Autumn. I've heard Autumn's voice on sound recordings. And again, some of my favourite sound recordings actually are ones where Autumn is involved because he's almost... Well, he's obviously clearly fascinated, but there's often laughter when Orton's involved in recording. He often giggles quite infectiously with some of the informants about some of the words they're using or whatever. I can think of two or three recordings that burst into kind of quite spontaneous and genuine laughter, both Harold himself and the informant about the words or the language that they're talking about, or Orton then describes to the speaker as, you know, an archaic pronunciation that he uses that Orton thinks is wonderful that he still uses or whatever. So, yes, but I never met him. No.
Do you have any favourite recordings?
It's always very, very difficult. I've got one that I always come back to for a number of reasons, which is a recording of Miss Dibner in Wellick. You probably can recognise it because it is one of the most... visited on our website. Wellick, it's East Yorkshire, and there are a number of reasons why I like it. I think it reminds me very much of my grandma. Now, my grandma was from Yorkshire and not that part of Yorkshire and didn't have that dialect at all. She did speak West Yorkshire dialect. She was from Castleford, but not as broad as this speaker by any means. But there's a kind of quality about her delivery that was very familiar. Similar generation, my grandma would have been slightly younger, but a sort of manner in the way she speaks that reminds me very much of that generation. But also the fact that it's, she's talking about baking bread. She's very, very enthusiastic. You immediately warm to her as a personality, as you do with many of the informants. But it's I think I often use it with school groups because it sounds to many young speakers nowadays as a completely remote voice. And yet the more you listen to it, there are aspects of not just change. So there are certain features that sound incredibly archaic to modern ears. But there are other features that are absolutely, you know, modern day Yorkshire dialect to this day. So I think it captures all sorts of things like that about the SED.
And when you were in your role at Leeds, what would you say was the spirit of the project?
Well, ultimately it was to preserve the collection in more appropriate conditions, but also to make it more widely available and accessible. So there was always an intention to have online access to the catalogue and to open it up to a wider field. So I think it was about, yeah, preservation and accessibility. I think, unfortunately, it wasn't possible in the duration of the project to give direct access to the material in a way that is now possible through the online digitised versions and the sound recordings at the library. But nonetheless, it kind of was that first step towards that. It made it more secure. It made it more findable. There was a kind of finding aid, etc. So, yeah, I think they were the main aims.
And you were talking about your day-to-day a bit and where you would work. Was that the scriptorium? Was that still in existence?
It wasn't the scriptorium. It was a very typical, you know, I remember being at Leeds myself as an undergraduate and having seminars and tutorials in these kind of buildings. So obviously, as you will know, Leeds has a big campus with purpose-built lecture theatres and seminar rooms, but it also has a number of rows of Victorian terraces that have been converted into department buildings. And so it was a very typical, almost seminar room. I imagine it had been a seminar room at some point in its life, yeah.
Did you ever go to the scriptorium?
I didn't. I don't even know whether it still existed, did it, the scriptorium, at the time I was there. No, I didn't. I imagine if it had, I would have been taken there. I mean, I've seen photographs of it. And obviously, I assume the name derives from the OED scriptorium, the James Murray scriptorium. There was, however, a thrill. I did find it very exciting. So every day or every other day, whenever I had to go and collect a new fieldworker's notebook, I did go into Special Collections. And Special Collections is in a lovely building. And going, even now at the British Library, going down to the stacks is quite a thrill, isn't it? So you see these rows and rows and rows of wonderful items. And in the case of the, you know, fieldworkers' notebooks, literally unique items, you know. Although I didn't go to a scriptorium, I did feel like I was going into a version of it when we went into the stacks.
And how did you come to finish at Leeds?
It was, so the job itself was a fixed term contract. I actually left slightly earlier than the contract. I think it was either 15 months or a year contract, and I didn't quite complete. So I'd started to work because at the time I had a young family. We had intended to move to Leeds with my job, because at the time my wife was looking after the children, because she was having a career break. So we did try and move up to Leeds in the hope that there might be an opportunity for work beyond the project. That didn't quite happen. So obviously that was a bit frustrating, being away from family. So after a few months, I was beginning to work 3 days up in Leeds and 2 days at home. So obviously beginning, therefore, to look beyond the end of the project, it was probably clear that I wasn't going to be looking for something to continue in Leeds. And again, quite by chance, I was very, very fortunate with the Leeds job. I was very, very fortunate with my current job. Quite by chance, the British Library had got in touch with Clive about the sound recordings of the SED. So the British Library had acquired digital copies of the sound recordings sometime in the early 1990s. Again, at a point where, and I don't know whether it was Clive or Stanley or somebody at Leeds had got very concerned about the survival of the sound recordings, particularly at that time. So had cobbled together a bit of money to digitise the discs and the tapes, which were digitised, I believe, through what used to be called the Northwest Sound Archive in Clitheroe, which no longer exists. So they digitised them and copies were kept there and sent to the British Library for preservation. So the British Library had had these recordings. There was no curator responsible for dialects or spoken English at the time at the library. So they kind of sat within oral history at the library. And Rob Perks, who was lead curator of oral history for a number of years at the library, he was very conscious that this was a wonderful collection and ought to be more widely available. So he and Clive had been in discussion. The British Library got funding from what was called the New Opportunities Fund, then now Heritage Lottery. They got funding to digitise a number of items at the library to put online for a project called Collect Britain, i.e. the focus was on British culture, British society. So there were a number of photographs, topographical drawings, sound recordings, wildlife sounds, oral histories, all sorts of things that went on a website that was called Collect Britain. So anyway, one of the roles in that project was for a linguist to work with the Survey of English Dialect sound recording. So the timing was unbelievable, really, for me. And Clive very kindly alerted me to this and said that this was going to happen. So I can't remember whether I'd done a full year at Leeds or just shy of a year, and then transferred to the British Library, which again was a fixed term post of, I think that was 18 months, to select, because the agreement with Leeds was to make excerpts available online from the Survey of English Dialects. And what I then worked on with Rob Perks at the library was we decided it would be good to match those with comparable recordings from a more recent collection. So the job was effectively to put Survey of English Dialects recordings online, select them, put a little bit of interpretation alongside them. But it evolved when I arrived at the library. We decided we'd also match them with more modern recordings. So that was an 18-month post to extract some SED sound recordings, write a bit of a description about them, and then match it to an equivalent recording from a similar location in an archive called the Millennium Memory Bank, which is an oral history archive from 1999. So I constantly pinch myself. I've been very, very lucky in terms of the timing of these things, and it's all been very fortuitous. So that's how I arrived at the library.
And can you tell me a bit more about the story of your role there since?
Yes. So that was 2003-04, I think. So it was an 18-month fixed-term post. I think 2005, early 2005, we published the northern set of recordings from both the Survey of English Dialects and the Millennium Memory Bank, and had some wonderful publicity. So it was published in stages, so it was finally all published, I think, end of 2005. But when we went live in 2005 with probably about 100 or so recordings from the northern half of the SED and a similar from the Millennium Memory Bank, there was a huge amount of press coverage, which I think took everybody by surprise. And a wonderful response from the public, from academics. So the library very quickly realised there was benefit in working more with these kind of collections. So Rob Perks and I tried to put together various proposals to continue this. Meanwhile, I was still working with the rest of the section. So the rest of the material went live later in 2005. Again, great publicity, great coverage and response. And we submitted a proposal to what was then the Department for DFES, Department for Education and Skills, was it called at the time, to work with this material, but to create a bespoke web resource for schools. So at the time, English language A-level had been around about 15, 20 years. So English language A-level, I think, emerged in the late 80s and had a slow take up, but by the end of the 90s was beginning to get increasing numbers and was a big growth area in school curriculum. So we were funded, so that was a again, I think an 18-month funding to create a website, which was called Sounds Familiar. Sounds Familiar was a selection of recordings from the Survey of English Dialects, from the Millennium Memory Bank, and from other collections that explored aspects of language variation and change that were on the English language A-level syllabus, with lots of teachers' resources and very kind of accessible interpretation. So that website launched, I think, in 2006 or so, maybe 2007. Again, we were delighted with the response. It was for many years the library's most visited learning resource. It still is, still has huge repeat numbers. It's embedded in all sorts of curriculum and syllabuses. So there are lots of repeat visits from schools, and now lots of universities use it as well for kind of undergraduate courses. And it's very accessible to the general public. So again, it kind of demonstrated the value of this kind of material for all sorts of audiences. So at that point, again, Rob and I and other colleagues in the library, so particularly in learning at the library, were putting in proposals for all sorts of other ideas, one of which was an exhibition, which did ultimately happen later, but that didn't quite happen at that time. And again, I keep thinking how lucky this all was. The library had a reorganisation in about 2007-8, and they created a new department called Social Sciences, and I applied for so at this point I was still on fixed term contracts. I applied for a permanent role in that department because it was kind of open as to what roles would be in there. There were going to be six, I think it was, what they called content specialists, but the subject specialisms were up for grabs. So I kind of put together a proposal for a sociolinguistics post within social sciences, and thankfully they agreed that sounded like a good idea given the kind of the success of the two previous projects. So I worked in a department called social sciences for about 5 or 6 years, which was mainly focused on taking our resources to researchers, so working very closely with university departments. It was more about outreach than about the collections themselves, that role. But nonetheless, because I was kind of the one expert, for want of a better word, in these collections, I did continue to work very closely with the Sound Archive on new collections coming in. So we acquired a couple of new collections while I was in that role. So the Survey of Anglo-Welsh Dialects, which obviously is the sister survey to Survey of English Dialects, came to the library at that point. What we call the Berliner Lautarchiv British and Commonwealth recordings, so that's a set of recordings of British POWs recorded in during the First World War in Germany. We acquired digital copies of those and a number of other smaller collections. Around the same time, BBC Voices had obviously occurred, and obviously my connection with Clive meant that I was quite closely involved with that. So that collection came to the British Library. And so that was my role for 5 or 6 years, possibly longer. And I can't remember exactly when, probably 2013, 14, roughly, the library had another reorganisation, as lots of big institutions do. And social sciences was that various people in social sciences were moved into other areas of the library. So I basically moved back into the Sound Archive, even though I'd continued to work very closely with the Sound Archive. I wasn't in the Sound Archive at that point. So at that point, I had no real responsibility for collections. It was more, as I say, about outreach and audiences. So for the last 7 or 8 years, I've been back in the Sound Archive as lead curator of spoken English, where my role is focused on the collections, i.e. the management of the collections, but also continuing to do that kind of outreach stuff that I did in social sciences. So, yeah.
What was it like when you first got to the library to work more closely with the recordings?
Again, an absolute joy. Yeah, I mean, I've often said I'm very lucky to do a job that I really enjoy and pursue a, you know, an interest that I've had for many years. So yes, it was fantastic to hear the voice, because obviously having worked on the fieldworkers' notebooks and you're reading these phonetic transcripts and you're picturing in your head how, because obviously they contain, in some cases, you know, pronunciations that I'd never heard in my life before. Could imagine somebody saying, and know, you know, knowing a little bit as I do about the history of the evolution of the English, I can picture, oh yes, that's the pronunciation because of whatever. But to actually hear these voices, and obviously you don't hear the interview process itself. There's a small number of recordings, actually. There's about half a dozen recordings where Stanley and one or two other field workers do go through small sections of the questionnaire. But I sense it's after the actual interview had been done. So it's kind of like a performance would be the wrong word, but it's not the full interview anyway. So you don't obviously hear all these pronunciations, but nonetheless, to hear these speakers speaking spontaneously and obviously the lives that they're describing are so remote from my experience, obviously in rural 1950s England, that it's a wonderful insight into their lives, but also, yeah, just great to hear those voices.
Can you tell me about BBC Voices?
Yes, so Clive, while I was working at Leeds in the archive, Clive had obviously had thoughts about a second survey, which at the time was the Survey of Regional English. So a number of PhD students, I think at the time I was there, Kate Wallace and Esther Asprey were at Leeds at the time, or maybe they'd just left, I can't remember, having done PhDs on, so in the case of Kate, it was on Southampton. In the case of Esther, it was on the Black Country. So they'd done PhDs using this new methodology that had been developed by Carmen Yamas in her work on Middlesbrough. So using this notion of kind of semantic fields to explore lexical variation. And do a more sociolinguistic interview than the kind of the SED type methodology. So this methodology had been evolving with Clive and Carmen, and then been applied to a number of PhDs. And I don't know how Clive approached the BBC, but obviously sometime in the early 2000s, this must have been happening. So by 2004-05, I was at the library, but Clive was keeping me posted of this potential project with the BBC. So they used a kind of pared-down version of the Survey of Regional English network sheets for language, which the BBC called a spidergram, and it's got 40 prompts on it. And so obviously, at that point, I imagine to replicate an SED-type survey would have been huge expense for a university, and you know, I don't know where they would have got that kind of funding from in terms of research councils. But obviously for the BBC, it clearly worked in terms of their broadcasting. They have a wonderful network of local radio stations. So through their local radio stations, they did the data gathering. So they conducted these interviews with their audio gatherers, as they called them. So effectively BBC journalists and producers. But it was based on the University of Leeds methodology, so they captured, and again, it's about 300, I think it's 315 or something, locations across the UK in this case, rather than just England. Each local radio station did about 5 or 6 interviews with a cross-section of their kind of community, so they tried to include old, young, rural, urban, different kind of speaker groups. So unlike the SED, it's kind of socially inclusive. So there are RP speakers, there are traveller communities, there are non-native speakers of English interviewed and all that kind of thing. So yes, I attended a number of meetings in the run-up to this, and the British Library were from the outset considered to be the archival partner. So the BBC did the audio gathering, the University of Leeds were going to do the research on the data gathered, and we were going to be the repository for the sound recordings. I also, now I remember, was seconded to the BBC for about 3 months, which again was wonderfully exciting, working at the BBC. So that was at the point that they'd collected all their material. They had a website called BBC Voices, which had a lot of content on it, extracts from the interviews. There were all sorts of interactive maps where you could see different words in different locations. There were lots of articles by academics and by kind of people commenting on language, lots of interactivity with the public about their thoughts and attitudes to language and dialect and accents, etc. So I was seconded for 3 months from the library to the BBC to oversee the receipt of the material, but also to contribute to their website. So the website, sadly, is no longer live at the BBC. It's archived at the BL. But I produced a couple of articles on some of the audio clips that they'd broadcast that just explored aspects of words, pronunciation, grammar sort of thing. So, yeah.
And can you tell me a bit more about the Evolving English exhibition as well?
Yes, so as I mentioned before, one of the things we were thinking about in when I was not on a permanent post at the library was what other things we could do to tap into this clear interest in the English language. And so one of the ideas was an exhibition. So by the time I'd got a permanent post in social sciences, one of the first things I did was I applied for a couple of research funds. So I applied to the Leverhulme Trust for a 3-year project to work on the BBC Voices. And at the same time applied internally for an exhibition at the BL. So the way it works at the British Library is we are sometimes approached by externals, or we as curators or other people at the library come up with an idea. And there's a sort of a 3 or 4 year lead time for an exhibition. So at the moment we've got an exhibition that's about to go live called Breaking the News, looking at our newspapers and radio news broadcast, etc., and online stuff that we acquire now. So that the idea for that was probably about 4 or 5 years ago. So anyway, we had an idea that we wanted to explore this interest in the English language. We were very keen to work with somebody like David Crystal, who we knew would be able to have the kind of historical overview that I didn't have, it and that expertise wasn't in the library. We have wonderful curators and librarians who have the expertise in the historical material, but not necessarily in the English language that could be explored through that. So we came up with a proposal, which we were asked to then develop further. And so we came up with this idea that we were going to work with David Crystal to explore about 1,000 years of the evolution of the English language through our library collections. So there were a number of themes that we were exploring. But the idea was that we were keen to show that at all points in time you could show that language was used differently in different geographic places by different speakers for different purposes for different audiences. So we were keen not to have it, although we did explore dictionaries and that kind of thing. We didn't want it to be a kind of an exhibition of dictionaries and glossaries and what people might think of as English language documentation sort of thing. More everyday objects that showed something about the English language, and also lots and lots of audio visual. So that was the idea. We did work with other places to have some loaned objects. So we did use some items from the OED scriptorium, for instance, and one or two items from other archives. But it was mainly British Library collections. It was manuscripts. It was sound recordings. It was personal correspondence, early print, some kind of iconic literary objects, but explored from a linguistic point of view rather than the fact that they're iconic literary items, and lots of kind of interactive games, if you like, about language, and lots of things to do with humour and slang and dialect and those kind of aspects of language that we knew from our website, that kind of personal response to English that we all have was what would attract audiences. So that was 2000, and in the end it was 2010-11, and it was called Evolving English, One Language, Many Voices. And it also brought you to the library, as you know, because one of the things that we were very excited about was we thought it was an opportunity to create a new collection. So at the end of the gallery, visitors were offered the opportunity to make a contribution by recording something for the library. So they could either record a reading passage, which we chose as Mr. Tickle, for a number of reasons. It's a children's book, so simple language, but also contains a wide range of vowel and consonant combinations. So they could either read Mr. Tickle, or they could donate a word that they felt was special in their variety of English, so dialect, slang, familect, whatever it might be. And we thought we'd get an enthusiastic response, and some hundred, as I think you know, because you came to work on the collection, I think something about 12, 13,000 contributions. And the exhibition itself was at the time the most visited BL winter BL exhibition. It ran from November through to April. It was our biggest ever exhibition in terms of schools programme, because obviously it was very closely linked to curriculum subjects and a big events programme. And again, demonstrated how well received this kind of material is and how interested and engaged people are in English language. But the collection was about 13,000, which we called the Voice Bank, which were these recordings of Mr. Tickle and these contributions of these words. And you'll be delighted to know, Rosie, we've just finished cataloguing them. So you came, I think, in 2017 and contributed a number, probably 1,000 and more, catalogue records of that collection.
How does that feel to have it finished?
Yes, relieved and excited at the same time. So I forget the exact numbers, but I think it's something like 8,000 Mr. Tickles in a variety of accents, so predominantly British English, but of course we had visitors from all over the world, and of course being in London, we had visitors from London who themselves are not necessarily speakers of British English. There is a predominance of Southeast England voices, but nonetheless, we've got, you know, all corners of the world represented in that. And something like, I think, 5,000 contributions of people who donated words. Now, in some cases, that might be a single word, but in some cases, people donated their family glossary, if you like. And they're wonderful because people... There were some linguists who contributed, obviously, because they were visitors, but in most cases, it's people who just have a genuine interest in English and a love of English, and therefore describe their local dialect word or their mate slang terms in very enthusiastic terms, and give all sorts, you know, go into detail about how they use it and what it means to them and that kind of thing. So it's a wonderful resource. Some of it's been made available online, and we're hopeful we're relaunching our Sounds website, which has got the SED and all those other collections on at the moment. We're relaunching that this year, hopefully in May, with a huge amount of new content, including hopefully much of this voice bank, so that it will be more widely available.
Did anything from the LAVC feature in your exhibition?
It did, yes. We had lots of Survey of English Dialects material in there. We had a couple of images from field workers' notebooks, and in the area that explored dialect, we had an interactive. One of the most frequently used interactive exhibits was a. It was on a kind of screen, and you could move across a map and click on a location and listen to a sound recording of either Survey of English Dialects or other collections. So all the Survey of English Dialects recordings were available in the exhibition. Exhibition colleagues talk about dwell time, which is the amount of time people spend in front of an object or whatever. And the dwell time for that particular installation was the best of all. So clearly, again, demonstrating that, you know, people really engaged with this material and enjoyed it. So yes, there were SED kind of archival material in there and the sound recordings and other not SED material or Lee's archive material, but kind of stuff spinning off from that.
So Johnny, what does this all mean to you? Why do you feel engaging with people about dialect is important?
I always found that very difficult to answer, but I think it typically, and I'm sure you find this and other people do, the number of times we engage in a conversation about language, just with a friend, just you hear somebody from your town and you kind of immediately want to talk to them or whatever. So I think there's that automatic personal interest. And I'm very lucky to say that, you know, I say I love doing the job I do, but I quite often people say, oh gosh, it sounds such a wonderful job, you're so lucky. So I think The fact that I am privileged to be working with a wonderful collection and with a subject that does appear to engage lots of people on lots of different levels. We have all sorts of, you know, people have an interest in English for a variety of purposes. And I think what I enjoy about working at the library is it gives you that opportunity to engage with a variety of audience. So yes, As I think I said earlier, I always thought I'd end up in some form of teaching. I still am able to do a bit of teaching. We have a lot of programs with schools. So I do the nice bits of teaching. I don't have to do the marking and the examining and testing. I just go and engage with a school group and you know, talk language with them. And I also work closely with universities. So although I didn't end up at university, I do work very closely with collaborating on research projects or again going and doing the odd seminar or talk, but also the fact that the library is very much, I think, when I first joined the library, there were a lot of older colleagues who were excited about what they perceived to be a change in the library, where the library had been generally considered a research library and used by academics and almost the general public were unaware of what was there and that they could use it. But there has been a lot of work at the library to be more open to the general public, because we are, of course, the National Library. And obviously, making things available online in the last 20 years or so has made that more possible. So yes, that opportunity to kind of get that material out there. And once it's out there, we don't know who, you know, occasionally you get an email from somebody who's delighted to have been able to use this material. And of course, in most cases, you don't know who's using it. You just get user figures and what have you. So, yeah.
If there was a fire and you had to save one thing from the LAVC.
From the LAVC? One? Oh, dear. It can't be all the notebooks, can it? So it's one item. Gosh, I really don't know. Gosh, it's 20 years since I was there. One item. I'd find that very, very difficult. What would I say from one item? That photograph of Stanley Ellis with, is it Tom Mason? Obviously, some of the fieldworkers' notebooks, you'd be distraught if they went, even the basic volumes themselves, but then they're available elsewhere. I don't know the half of what exists in the archive because, as I say, I was only really working with the fieldworkers' notebooks. Occasionally, Robin or Catherine would say, oh, gosh, you've got to look at this, Johnny, or I'd go and see what they were working on. So I did see some of the photographs. I did see some of the correspondence and what have you. So I'm not aware of some of the material that exists, but that photo somehow captures, obviously, what I've subsequently been working on. I'm conscious I've been working on stuff other people have created. I've never done field work, for instance. I've not created any resources. Obviously, I was responsible for the voice bank at the exhibition, but it wasn't, you know, that happened. That was crowdsourced, if you like, physically in one location, obviously. But so I've never done, got my hands dirty in creating stuff. So that photograph somehow captures what Stanley and others were doing for the rest of us, sort of thing. And the informants, of course, as well.
Can I ask you a bit now about your own dialect story?
Yes. One of a mixed story, really. So I suppose the reason I've always been interested in this is I come from a mixed marriage in the sense that my dad's from Yorkshire and my mother's from the Black Country, from Walsall. My dad grew up in Castleford. In West Yorkshire, and my mum grew up in Walsall in the West Midlands, and they met when my dad was working in Birmingham, and subsequently moved back to Yorkshire where I was born. So my early years were in Pontefract, near Castleford. The whole of that side of my family has remained in Castleford, living very, very close to each other. So all my aunts, uncles, cousins still live either Castleford or Pontefract. And so both my grandparents from Castleford. My grandfather, I would have described as a dialect speaker. My grandmother could speak dialect, but probably would be described as having an accent rather than a dialect. But my grandfather was, you know, used thee and thou very naturally, and often entertained and amused us with his kind of jokes in dialect, etc., etc. So obviously, I was very familiar with that. One of my uncles, my uncle Gary, spoke even broader. I mean, he really was almost SED type speaker. Very broad dialect speaker. So obviously that input and growing up there fascinated me. We moved, and I went to secondary school in the Midlands, so we moved to near where my mum was from. We moved to a town called Sutton Coldfield in Birmingham, and I went to secondary school there. And my mum's parents were both Walsall accent rather than dialect, but aware of Walsall dialect. And I obviously encountered it through the extended family. So I was conscious growing up that, you know, there were these two very different versions of English in my family. We then moved when I was going into sixth form down to Eastbourne. And that was probably the first time I was very conscious that I spoke differently from everybody around me. So I didn't have a Yorkshire accent. I suppose when I was in Sutton Coldfield, I probably had a Sutton Coldfield accent. I now have a kind of, I think, a vaguely northern / Midlands accent that very people find very difficult to place as a result of all this that's been going on so far. When we moved to Eastbourne, that I suppose was the first time I became conscious that I don't sound like anybody around me. And I think was something I played on a little bit maybe at that time, but also was interested in, you know, encountering a new dialect in Eastbourne that was completely different. Then, of course, like all of us, you go to university, and in my first year, I was in a hall next to a RP speaker, opposite a very broad Geordie, who was next to a Mancunian, who, et cetera, et cetera. So, as you do at that age, you kind of, you explore that, I hope humorously, but in some cases possibly, you know, other people have negative experiences of that. But in my case, it was a positive experience of this kind of mishmash of voices that we all celebrated, a very good friend with a strong Liverpool accent, etc., etc. Met my wife there, who's from Ashbourne. She has a recognisable Ashbourne accent, and her family are all there. And what's really interesting about my family is she does know Ashbourne dialect very, very well. She often comes out with things that I then flick through and look up in SED and or somewhere else and can locate to her area, although she doesn't speak it generally, but she has an Ashbourne accent. But neither of her brothers, so often she'll come out with a phrase and then I'll get excited and she'll ring her brothers and they'll go, oh no, I haven't heard it. So she's quite intrigued about her dialect story, if you like, because she thinks she must have been, her friendship groups in Ashbourne must have been much more local people than, for whatever reason, her brothers hung around with, one of whom still lives in Ashbourne and yet still doesn't really engage with the local dialect. So yeah, that's my dialect story to university. And then, of course, we moved here. I taught in Macclesfield for a while, and then we moved to here and I taught in Marlow. And then that's when I started pursuing my interest, I suppose, more professionally, and did the linguistics and ended up doing what I'm doing.
I'm going to move on now, Johnny, to, you've answered a few of these already, but just some more quickfire questions that we're asking everybody.
Okay.
And then if you're willing, I'd like to do our dialect survey.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm be fascinated, intrigued to do it. Yeah, of course.
Okay, so you've covered some of this, but when and where were you born?
I was born in Hemsworth in West Yorkshire, 1964, 12th of September. Hemsworth being the local maternity hospital to where we were living, which was Pontefract at the time.
Okay, and where do you live now?
I live in Sea Green, a village near Beaconsfield in Buckinghamshire.
And where did your parents grow up?
My dad grew up in Castleford, West Yorkshire, and my mum grew up in Walsall, hence she's my mum.
And what words do you use that are local to here?
To here? I don't know that I do use any words that are local to here. Would there be any? I don't think so. No, I can't say I use any words local to here.
And have you picked up any words or phrases from different people and places?
Absolutely, yes, definitely. So certainly words that I associate with my dad's family or my dad himself, i.e. Yorkshire words that I associate with my mom and her family, although not necessarily actively used, as I say, by the Walsall side of my family, but certainly known and enjoyed. And then definitely university years was a point when, as I say, I think hopefully among my friendship group, because we were from different parts of the country, we did enjoy each other's dialect words and expressions. And I think I and that friendship group would all be able to quote each other's words for this, that and that, because it was something we did play around with, sort of thing. So yes, I have picked up.
Do any words in particular come to mind that you do actually use from different people and places?
Yes. I mean, I do use... I'm trying to think now. So, the one I often quote is Donnie for hand, which is what my mum used to say when I was little, when crossing the road, give me your Donnie. I used it with my kids. They're conscious. They often tell story. They often tell stories about both me and my wife. Them going to school and using a word, and then suddenly they got to an age where they suddenly realised, oh God, it's another one of mum's or dad's words. And so they became conscious that they would try a word with their friendship group before they knew whether it was known or not. But Donnie is one that I used with the kids and that they know and use. They know exactly what it means, and I think they now look back on it fondly and affectionately. Yes, so.
Yeah. And how have you inherited any words from older relatives that you can describe?
So Nesh, and I definitely use Nesh quite regularly, because living in Britain, there is opportunity to be Nesh or witness people being Nesh quite regularly, isn't there? So, i.e. being sensitive to cold, although it can mean other things in other areas. So, Nesh, I don't know whether I picked that up from my mom or my dad or a grandparent, but it's certainly a word that I remember hearing and deciding was a good word, because there is no other word for it, sort of thing. Mardy, sort of for that sullen, spoilt child. Donnie obviously has a very restricted use. Mardy and Nesh I would use at any point. So I'm conscious that I probably, and being a linguist, you're aware that if you're using Mardy in Seer Green with people who live in Seer Green, you're almost asking for them to comment. Or, but nonetheless, I would use those words quite happily, naturally. And then other words that I'm conscious that I say out and note quite naturally with my wife and the kids, but I probably wouldn't say out and note around friendship groups here in Buckinghamshire in a way that I would say Nesh or Mardy. I suppose because, I don't know why, but out and note are kind of everyday words, aren't they? Nesh and Mardy are used on an occasion where you are almost trying to provoke or amuse, or aren't they? So anyway, yeah.
And how would you describe your own accent? Has it changed over time?
It has changed, because I don't have this sound recording now, which is awful considering I'm an archivist. But when we first moved to Eastbourne, we had an answerphone that had a recording both of my voice and my sister's voice answering or calling our parents and asking to be picked up or something. And I do remember for many years hearing that recording and hearing a lot more West Midlands in my voice than I think there is now. Obviously I've married someone from Ashbourne, so that's probably had an impact on my accent. Not that I'm saying I've got an Ashbourne accent, but it's probably, there are things I do. And obviously I've now lived in Buckinghamshire longer than I've lived anywhere, but I don't think I've necessarily picked up anything from Buckinghamshire. But it's probably meant that whatever Northern or Midlands elements were in my voice have been levelled, although I'm conscious, I say Bath, I say Cup, and there are probably one or two other things. So I've got a Northern RP, I don't know. It's different. Labels are wonderful and awful at the same time, aren't they? But yeah.
Johnny, thank you. It's been such a privilege.
Thank you.
I'm going to move on to the survey.
Of course, yeah.
Happy to do that. I think it will interest you.
So, oh, it's not that you ask me, do you, or I read it? No, you're going to ask.
I'm going to ask you. Yeah, we're going to do it.
So it's a quick fire thing, is it? I respond, or I've got time to think.
You can comment on things. You don't have to. It doesn't have to be super quick. But yeah, go with your instinct, I'd say. Not as long as the survey of English dialects.
Well, you'll be glad to hear as well, I'm sure.
So we'll start with some pictures.
Oh, great! Yeah.
What do you call this creature?
Am I going to need my glasses? Oh, I call that a hedgehog. I better get my glasses just in case.
And what do you call these?
Are they daddy? Is that a daddy long legs? Daddy long legs.
Thank you. And what about these?
Oh, now I would call that a leather jacket, I think. Yeah.
Cool, thank you. And what about your word for this type of garden weed?
We've got loads of it, and I never know quite what to call it. I think I call it Sticky Willy, but I know my wife doesn't like me calling it that. But
okay. And this is a drop of?
Water, or rain, or
in the morning.
Oh, dew.
Right,
yeah. Sorry.
Thank you. This is a bag of
sweets. Although my dad would call that spice, and my mom would call them sucks, and my wife would call them toffees. So I'm conscious there are, yeah, but I grew up calling them sweets, yeah, and would call them sweets.
What would you call one of these?
Now, it's soft, is it? What I'm looking at is a soft roll. Now, I would call that a bap, but if it were crusty, I would call it a cob. And again, I think that's from my mom. My mom calls crusty rolls cobs and soft rolls baps. My dad would call that a scuffler. My wife would call it a cob, whether it's soft, brown, round, square, hard, crusty, it would be a cob, but yeah. But I'd call that a bap because it's soft.
Okay.
Although, again, if I'm allowed to say, as a Coventry City fan, when I go to Coventry City matches and have chips inside that, I am always conscious of ordering a chip batch, because that's what they call in Coventry. So I suppose I haven't, and that is a word that I would. So I will go into our local bakers and ask for a cob, even though I know that they know me now, so they know what I mean by a cob, and I get a crusty roll. But I'm conscious that even if it's somebody new in there working there, I will still insist on saying, "Can I have a cob?" And they'll go, "What?" And I'll say, "So yeah."
Why is that?
I don't know. I think I do it because. I like calling it that, and actually it's quite a nice way of engaging with somebody who, because I go to the bakers regularly and I know them now, we often have a chat, but if there's somebody in there new, it's kind of like an icebreaker, isn't it? Oh, I'd like a cob, please, and then you start talking and etc. So yeah.
What do you call these?
Scones. And I do have the cream on top of the jam.
You do?
I do.
Another controversial topic. And how many are in the picture?
Three.
And what is your word for these, please?
Spring onions. Spring
onions. And what? Sorry?
What is this?
Piggyback.
And one more picture. What do you call this?
A seesaw.
Thank you.
Okay, next section. I've just got two sentence prompts for you.
So what I want you to do is
complete the sentence that you can see on the card by selecting the word that you would use in a conversation with friends. So you can take it.
Am I allowed one on? Oh, yeah, it says something else. I'd probably say the food was dead tasty.
Great.
Thank you.
And this one?
And
So again, the word that you would use in a conversation with friends there.
He asked me to fix it. I think if I were talking completely not thinking, I'd probably say I went. Obviously, I'm drawn to what I said in the sense of I'm reading it as a written thing, but I think if I were talking and I weren't thinking about it, I'd probably use I went.
Thanks. Okay, and then some questions. So what do you call a room in a house for storing food?
As in a kitchen or a pantry? As in the room. Is it a cupboard or is it a room? Kitchen. For storing food. Well, we've got a pantry.
That's the sort of thing I'm talking about. If you haven't eaten any food for a long time, you're bound to feel...
Hungry.
What words do you use for something to eat, possibly between meals?
As in a snack. I do call it a snap, actually, again, from my dad. But again, I'm conscious that I do so. It wouldn't have been the word I used as a child to friends, but it's kind of a link with my dad. I call it snap. And the kid, my kids know I call it snap. And I jokingly say, if I make sandwiches because we're going away or they're going, I'll say, do you want some snap? So I do use snap, but very much within the family and not beyond. I would call it a snack elsewhere.
What do you call a coffee that you might get from a cafe with lots of milk?
Latte.
What's the dairy product that you spread on toast and sandwiches?
Butter.
Which word or phrase would you use to indicate a temporary break in a game when points cannot be scored?
As in half time. Temporary break in a game.
Like a playground game, more like.
Oh, when you're barley, as in that, barley. Yeah.
Okay. If you fall over in the playground, your knee might be
grazed.
If you got covered in dirt at the playground when you get home, you might need to get in the
bath.
When children are very excited, you might say they are full of
beans.
At the end of a long and tiring day, you'd say you were absolutely jiggered. And which word would you use to mean not attending school?
I don't know, because unfortunately I know so many now. I think I would have said bunk off when I was a kid. But I've taken to saying nick off or wag off because that's what my mom says. But I think naturally growing up I would have said bunk off because presumably that was the word used in Sutton Coldfield at the time.
Sometimes when children are being very naughty, their parents tell them that someone will come take them away. What do you call this mysterious person if you have a word for them?
I don't. We never have done that with our children. My dad used to say the policeman would come and take us away. But yeah, I've not done that and therefore don't have a word I would naturally use.
You grow crops and raise animals on a farm. When you walk in the countryside after heavy rain, your shoes will get covered in
mud, water, yeah, mud.
When driving in icy or wet weather, you must take care because the roads are
slippery. Now, that's one of the words we share among our friendship group at university. A mate from Barrow-in-Furness always uses the word slape. For that, and so we have within that friendship group adopted it. We always, if ever we're together and it is icy, we'll almost race to be the first person to say, "Hey, Phil, it's slape out or whatever." Yeah, but my word is slippery. Yeah.
Which word do you use as a term of endearment, even with strangers?
That I've definitely adopted, and I don't use it with strangers, but with. With strangers, I don't think I do use a form of address with strangers, but with close family, I now occasionally do use duck, which my wife, when I first met her, used naturally and continues to. But for me, it's an adopted form of address and only used to a small circle of close family.
Which word would you use to refer to someone as very attractive?
I'm of an age where that's not an appropriate thing to do anymore. But when I was young, fit, we'll do the word I and my peers used, yeah.
What's your word for spreading rumours?
Gossip.
Picture not hanging straight is hanging.
Skew whiff.
What do you call the very small piece of wood that's got into your finger?
Again, from my dad, I call it a spelk, but that's absolutely adopted from my dad. Splinter would be the word I would use when talking to other people, but I do consciously use spelk within family as a means of kind of keeping that word alive, as it were, in our family anyway. It's very much alive elsewhere, of course. But
what do you call a person who mends shoes and boots?
Cobbler.
And do you have any other words you'd like to tell us about?
Are there any other words? I'm sure there are many. I mean, other words that we use within the family that have come from different sources. Is that of interest, or how long have you got? No, but I'll stick to a few. So my wife, as I say, has got a number of expressions that I often get excited about and we then explore. So sat there like piffy being one, as in if somebody's being you, so people are, I don't know, getting tea ready, tidying up, doing something, and somebody, everybody's got one member in the family who doesn't contribute. She always says, what are you doing sat there like piffy? So we do use that within the family. Other terms that we might use. So, and going back to the games thing, I'm very conscious that my kids, having grown up in Buckinghamshire, have a number of terms they use for games that I would have used different words. So obviously the prompt was for barley, wasn't it? But I call that game, or the general chase game, I call TIG. My kids call it IT. What they call 40-40, which is the game where everybody runs away and they've got to get back to a tree or a lamppost or a bench before the catcher finds them. I would call that Aki 1-2-3. Terms. I'm sure things will come to me when you've gone. But no, that. Just give me a moment to think. What are other ones that we commonly use? That's fine.
I think I'm going to adopt sat there like piffy now.
Oh yeah, it captures. Yeah, whoever piffy was, I don't know, but having looked it up, it's always difficult to say these things, isn't it? But there's lots of stuff online from the kind of Manchester down to Birmingham area, which is obviously where Ashbourne is. So it would appear it's used there and maybe elsewhere.
Love it. Johnny, I've taken lots of your time. I'm going to stop recording now.